Philadelphia, Philadelphia, are you ready? City of brotherly love, home of smoking Joe Frazier. Come on. It's about that time. FetLifeStation.com. Philly Fridays, baby. Come on.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Thank you so much for tuning in to Fet Life Station Internet Radio. You are listening to Life Without Parole, LWOP Radio. My name is Stacey Mandel. I'm in Philadelphia, where it's definitely still a Philly thing. And I have the honor of co-hosting this show with Robert Groves, aka Reentry Rob. Rob is almost 27 years down. Hi, Rob.
Good morning.
Good morning. I was saying you're almost 27 years down, between 26 and 27, I believe.
Correct.
On your life without the possibility of parole sentence at SCI Phoenix. And Rob's been standing by, so I want to be quick. Just want to say real quick that he is going to be posing all of his really critical, enlightening questions to Mr. Brandon Flood. Brandon is Ceasefire PA's Deputy Director of Government Affairs. And due to logistics, we're going to get fierce right off the bat here with Rob and Brandon. And then when Rob has to go, I will continue on with Brandon so that we can understand more of what Brandon is doing in his role, actually his various roles. So let's get to it.
Well, good morning, Stace. Good morning, LWOP listeners. And Mr. Flood, good morning to you and welcome as well, sir.
Hey, good morning, Rob.
I just want to thank you before we jump into our line of questions. I just want to thank you.
SCI, Phoenix State Correctional Institution.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
I want to thank you for carving out some time. You know, I know your schedules are extremely hectic. Before we jump into the interview, though, I was in attendance at a presentation you did on the behalf of the BOP for Men's Fit workshop here at Phoenix about 4 years ago. I was the facilitator for the RSO. And my supervisor, Miss Casey, you know, introduced us, and it's crazy how, you know, things just came full circle. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna jump straight in. Mr. Flood, you have well over a decade of advocacy and governmental relations experience. Where do you stand in reference to second opportunities for lifers and those serving death by incarceration sentences?
Yeah, I mean, during my time as Secretary of the Board of Pardons, certainly I've been a proponent of second chances and more importantly, you know, doing away with life and instituting parole eligibility. You know, obviously, I feel like everyone deserves an opportunity to be heard or considered. And obviously, you know, the outcomes will vary depending upon merit and other factors, too. You know, one thing that I say I'm big on ensuring that the victim community's input is heard. So, no, I consider myself a proponent, you know, and will be a proponent, you know, irrespective of whatever I'm doing professionally.
Absolutely. And I want to tie that in because exactly what you said as far as taking, you know, taking the victims in consideration, and that comes behind also being able to better ourselves. And I believe that if a life sentence is simply to ensure particular individuals are removed from society, I think we're failing horribly as a nation. I'll give you an example. Those serving life without parole sentences, you know, despite the growth one has made or exemplified, it seems like we're never considered. And I mean that through the judicial process, and I mean like court stipulated, you know, options where we would be able to go ahead and show exactly what we've done throughout our incarceration. And the only outlet we have for that currently is commutation. And most prisons, the system itself becomes complicit in that lack of development. It's evident in the DOC's lack of educational programming opportunities. So those serve long term or death by
SCI, Phoenix State Correctional Institution.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Mr. Flood, you clearly understand the inner workings and mechanisms of the Board of Pardons. My question is, despite checking all the boxes in regards to being a liable candidate for commutation, if these same individuals don't receive the necessary 5-0 vote in order to be commuted, why isn't there a system in place informing those same individuals why, so they could address the BOP's concerns or reasons for denial.
Yeah, I mean, that's been, you know, I agree with you. That's something that when I was secretary, I presented to the board and tried to get them to get to a point where even if we were going to offer formal opinions that, you know, given I know the volume of cases that we hear, both pardons and commutations, not even proposing them that we just do it exclusively for commutation cases. Now, unfortunately, I wasn't able to build consensus amongst the board members to adopt that policy. And, you know, so I'm thinking that, you know, it's looking like they're not going to do it voluntarily. So certainly it's going to require some legislative action. But I'm a supporter of that because you can't address your deficiencies if you don't know what areas you're deficient in.
Well, allow me a second to provide an example, and I'm glad that you pointed that out. And I kind of had an understanding that you had that view, because when we were walking back, I remember when you were leaving the institution that day, and we were walking back with my supervisor. I remember, you know, I was asking you questions. You kind of pointed that out, but I wanted to know why listeners and society hear that as well. When you run a diagnostic check on electrical equipment, it's to see if things are operating under normal parameters. So it's like the same thing. A job of a troubleshooter is to locate the problem and make the repairs to the equipment. In order to fix any problem, you must first define it. So it's like when I watched these brothers come back and they got shot down because, you know, they didn't get the necessary votes. It's like they're in complete limbo. They have no idea what to go back and address. And it's just heart-wrenching. And I'm glad that you did say, and that kind of like skips my next question, because I was going to ask you, would you support legislation addressing that issue? And you obviously covered that, because FAM, we just had Ms. Maria Garner and Ms. Trustee on the show a couple weeks back. And shout out to them and what they're doing. But they have something currently in the workings on a proposal for that. So I'm glad to hear that you would support that as well.
Absolutely.
Looking back, has your view changed on should elected officials sit as members of the Board of Pardons?
I've always been a proponent. Before I even came on as secretary, and I was pretty knowledgeable, at least from a policy standpoint, of how executive clemency works in Pennsylvania. So, you know, it may surprise you to know that both I and former victim advocate of PA, Jennifer Storm, we were proponents of depoliticizing the board because, oftentimes it's the politics of it all that overshadowed the merit of an applicant. So having an attorney general and a lieutenant governor on those boards, they're not looking at the sheer merit of a case. They're looking at possible political implications for them. So I've always been a supporter of that policy even prior to my time on the board, and that remains my position to this day.
And just to expand on that a little further, so our listeners can understand, in the mid-90s, during the governor's race between Lieutenant Governor Mark Single and Tom Ridge, Mr. Single, the chair of the commutation board, which voted to free Mr. Reginald McFadden, who eventually went out to commit more heinous crimes. Mr. Single, at the time, had a double-digit lead, but watched it shrink, and eventually he lost. Tom Ridge strategically used that release of McFadden to bolster his campaign run to win the election. So decisions in the form of votes should never be convoluted by the board's personal positioning of future aspirations. Now, before I go any further, I want to go ahead and first of all say that what that man went out there and did was horrendous.
Right.
But from that point on, we use that one example to go ahead and blanket the commutation process as a whole. When it's a statistical fact that those that have been released after serving life or 30, 40, 50 years or whatever it may be, I mean, they return less than 1% of the time, or I think it's at 1% of the time. So
right.
I'm glad that you kind of covered that the politics, that shouldn't be a part of that process.
Right.
Okay. I want to say, do you support Mrs. Joanna McClinton's House Bill 1719, which will return it to a 3-2 majority vote instead of the 5-0 unanimous vote in order to be commuted?
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly that was something that I'm going to say was a policy that originated with former Lieutenant Betterman did Former Speaker Clinton, during the time when she was drafting that legislation, we also consulted with Senator Cameron Bartolotta that has a similar policy. I know at one point she had one that was reverted to four votes, but I think she may have revised it to a simple majority carries the day. So always been a supporter of that. You know, you won't find a similar mechanism that exists in terms of voting protocol in any other state or jurisdiction. The simple majority has always carried the day. So definitely a supporter.
Yeah, that, and I don't want to say that simple change, because obviously we're talking about legislation. We're talking about legislation here, but that change could double the amount of those granted a reprieve. You know, as of right now, you know, there's no other mechanism in place other than the judicial route. You know, in the form of overturning your conviction. You know, commutation is like our only release mechanism right now, right. And I just believe that, you know, and a majority, I've been really studying for the last 4 to 5 years, Mr. Fly. I've been studying how, if you look at the votes, you rarely see a 4-1. So it seems like, and I'm not saying this, I'm not throwing no conspiracy theories out there, but it seems like it's always a 3-2, like they're voting in tandem. And I don't know if that's, you know, if that's just the views of certain people, because you can just agree on certain things. You know what I'm saying? But it seems like it's rarely a 4-1 vote. Have you ever noticed that?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly been instances where members have voted with one another. I mean, you see the same thing in the General Assembly, where they vote and will vote solely based upon how another person voted, not even reviewing what legislation before them. You know, human nature sometimes dictates that, whether it's right or wrong. But yeah, there's certainly folks that would have, and as you said, it's not my suggestion. It works up. Folks in that, right, you know,
before. Yeah, it's just, I appreciate that. I want to go ahead and dive into our next question, but I see that we're getting real tight. And they're about to give me a 1-minute warning. So if we do get cut off, I'm going to come right back to this same identical question.
Okay.
Mr. Flood, you being a dual victim, one who has served time and who also is a survivor of gun violence, there couldn't be a more qualified person to speak on these issues. How has your experience helped you and Ceasefire PA?
You have 1 minute left.
On trying to address this gun violence epidemic we are currently experiencing. Do me a favor, please hold your thought on that. I'm going to reread the question. I'm going to be right back with you. LWAP listeners, don't go nowhere. Reentry Rob will be right back in about a minute.
Yep, we're going to take a quick musical interlude here, get Rob back on the line, and we'll be right back into it.
The caller has hung up.
I got my eyes on you. You're everything that I see. I want your high love and emotion endlessly. I can't get over you. You left your mark on me. I want your high love and emotion endlessly. 'Cause you're a good girl and you know it. You act so different around me. 'Cause you're a good girl and you know it. Exactly who you could be. Just hold on, we're going home. Just hold on, we're going home. It's hard to do these things alone. Just hold on, we're going home. Everything that I see, I want your high love and emotion endlessly. I can't get over you. You left your mark on me. I want your high love and emotion endlessly. 'Cause you're a good girl and you know it. You act so different around me. 'Cause you're a good girl and you know it. Exactly who you could be. So just hold on, we're going home.
we're back.
Yes, I just we got my co-host, Miss Stacey Mandel, and we got Mr. Brandon Flood on the line. So sorry for the interruption, y'all, but you know this is what brings validity to this show. We're doing it from live from prison and also from the outside, so that's what makes this show so unique. Mr. Flood, I left off on the question where you being a dual victim, one who served time and also a survivor of gun violence, there couldn't be a more qualified person to speak on these issues. And how has your experience helped you and Ceasefire on trying to address this gun violence epidemic we are currently experiencing?
Yeah. So. Well, you know, I have a very unique background. Not just, you know, you mentioned about being a gunshot survivor and also not being formally incarcerated, but I'm also a gun owner. I'm also a Republican now as well. I'm also someone who actively engaged in the straw purchasing process when I was a youth too. So purchasing those crime guns illegally. So now that informs me because I'm able to provide those perspectives and speak directly to what's fueling the proliferation of crime guns in our communities. Obviously being able to tap into some of the thinking from our conservative legislators when it comes to gun safety legislation. So I'm able to bring a lot of that lived experience to the table. And then also having that policy-based experience of working in the legislature and just working in the government affairs space. So I'm able to meld all of those qualities, all of those experiences together to really inform what we lobbying efforts.
It takes what I've noticed is it's nothing more powerful than like the peer on peer to have somebody be able to look at somebody and be like, wait a minute, he or she understands exactly what I'm going through, things that I'm experiencing, and I'm going to give you a prime example of that. And here, what I've noticed most is, and that means in prison, that if you don't get your mindset together first, you can't do nothing. Nothing else follows. And I think that's what's plaguing our youth right now. So I'm going to give you an example. How do you convince someone they're lost when they identify with their current conditioning? Their inner GPS, their moral compass, it signals they're on course. They see no reason to ask for direction, so they drive aimlessly in the wrong direction. The roadside rest stop eventually becomes a correctional institution, or worse, their final resting place. It seems like prison isn't even a deterrent no longer. It's like a badge of honor, you know, for this small batch of people committing these heinous crimes out there in the streets. So it's like their stripes are handed out by their peers, passengers on the same destructive journey. So like when you pull over this metaphorically impaired driver, right, how do you convince them to put their guns down? And this is what we need to convince these people that are doing it. It's because their gun, people don't understand, their gun provides number one protection, because people feel as though when you live in certain communities, you have to have a gun because it's so crazy out there in the world. So now you not only have unregistered gun owners, now you have people that feel as though they have to protect themselves and their family.
This
now
is
we
a
have
call
this
from
influx
FBI, Phoenix
of
State
everybody
Correctional Institution.
Just
this
having firearms.
To recording and monitoring.
But going back to these individuals that I'm talking about, it also gives the unparalleled power. It's like a resource, you know, for them, you know what I mean? And it inflicts fear to anyone who's challenging that notion. So I kind of wanted to point that out, Mr. Flood, that when we're like trying to come up with new unique approaches where we're not kind of like remixing, you know, for a better sense of word, of doing the same things over. Have you noticed that, like, when you speak to the youth, or you're speaking to certain individuals that are going through this, have you noticed that nobody has spoken to these kids? Nobody has taken the time to ask them what's going on with them?
Right. No, you make a good point. You know, obviously we can't solve everything legislatively or through policy change. You know, there needs to be a culture shift, and one way to shift culture is to engage with people that are directly impacted or directly involved or contributing to the problem. So, you know, I know that's something that I make a point to do. You know, certainly it's easier to be able to change the minds of our youth as opposed to some adults. Sometimes they can become a little bit more entrenched in their thinking. But yeah, I mean, I'm big on surveys and polls, and that's something that I even think about doing or thought about doing with the DOC is maybe some doing some surveying of a certain subset of offenders, especially males and females, but a particular target age range to be able to dig deep and to your point, be able to get some insight directly from the horse, so to speak, the horse's mouth, so to speak.
It's crazy that you just said that, Mr. Flood.
Correctional Institution.
I'm hoping you see that. You obviously see, we share that sentiment. We just started this workshop, and what we're doing is we're targeting what we noticed inside the prisons, the ages between 18, 25, almost 30. That's the majority of the ones that are committing the violence in prison, and also the drug usage, the drug pushing and stuff like that. So we just actually started this mentoring group called Big Bros. And what we're doing is we're sitting down. We have we targeted the 18 and almost 30-year-olds in the jail. We're sitting down with them, and we're starting off trying to get a better understanding who they are as men. What are their ideals? What do they see as far as future? What do they define as a man? What do they define as success? So we're also strategically, each facilitator in there kind of brings something different to the table. And I'll just give you an example with me. I work for parole. I'm on reentry rob. I make sure I get all the resources these men need before they go home, linking them up with people such as yourself, that help them out with that reentry phase. So I know how super busy you are, but I'm definitely going to tap back into you, and we might see if we can go ahead and work something out that maybe you can even come and speak to these individuals. But it's crazy that you said that.
Listen, definitely, again, just because I no longer work for government, I think really working outside of government gives me more flexibility. I can be more vocal and obviously speak to some more of the injustices within the system, too. Not that I couldn't, but certainly I had to be strategic and think about the men and women that I was helping in that role. But I say all that to say is, I intend to visit our institution. So all you need to do is extend me an invitation. I'll gladly come and consider me as a resource moving forward.
Absolutely. That's great. That's great news. They say education plus resources equals economical advancement. Reentry-based solutions should start at ground zero, meaning while those are still incarcerated. Have you ever considered, and you tied into this, have you ever considered or attempted to partner with the Secretary of Corrections in order to increase the likelihood of success for returning citizens?
Yeah, so I did have a chance to speak with acting Secretary Laura Harry, Dr. Harry, I should refer to her as. Yeah, so I did have a chance to speak with her, from the time that she was nominated, from the time that she was actually confirmed by the Senate. So I've expressed my interest in working collaboratively with the DLC. My emphasis was more so on computation, but certainly I'm willing to work with the DLC in whatever area that they feel like they need. I think their deputy director of reentry, they're still trying, the budget is still technically pending too. So yeah, the conversation has been initiated, and I intend to at least stay engaged with Secretary Harry to find some ways for us to collaborate.
That's great. I kind of want to stay on that subject. I think that it's important for people to understand that 95% of those incarcerated at one point or another are going to return to society. So it's not only important for their personal success, but also to the communities that they will be returning to. And what I've noticed, I've been working in this field now close to 12 years, and this is even before we had a reentry service office. I just was working in a library, and I was in charge of all the reentry materials. So I would just, sit down with the men, until I'm blessed to get my shot at freedom again. I wanted to make sure that I can go and help out those with theirs. But what I noticed is our curriculum is either outdated, it's not relatable. We just talked about if you're going to go ahead and have something come from a person, it has to come from a person that they can go ahead and relate to. And I'm show you exactly what I'm talking about. Working in the reentry field for that long, right, with me coming in contact, there was this is three-step process that I stick to, right? And I think there's a process, Mr. Flood, even before the reentry, and I call it pre-entry. And that's the mental aspect behind creating faith in oneself and applying that will to change. Like, what I noticed is a lot of these dudes don't believe that door that they're reaching for could possibly be open. So my job is, my layer, that I call it, I sit down and let these men know, like I was inspired. I was so inspired when you came in, like, you know, just by your change and what you've been able to accomplish. So, like, I took that, you know, and I took a piece of that, and I kind of use you as an example and many others that have totally flipped their lives and look at the type of positions or walks of life they're in now. So I let these dudes know there's nothing you can accomplish. So that second stage, which is reentry, and I say that's acquiring the education, skill set, tools, and resources for that matter, and then activating them in your everyday life. And the last stage would be that reentrant, where the returning citizens, you know, who need resources and proven concepts, come to obviously people like you and other organizations that go ahead and help them out with that stage, that will produce desired results. Like, if this is accomplished, if you're surrounded by, you know, the reentrants are surrounded by people that take a personal interest in developing and implementing solutions, I mean, it catapults them, man. Just to know that these men know that, and women for that matter coming out of prison, just to know that they have a person, they shook their hand, and they're like, listen, when you get out of it, bro, I got you. That means so much, and you know that. I mean, when you was here, you toured the jails. Just a simple handshake, man, can go ahead and catapult somebody to go back in the cell and say, hold on, I'm changing my whole bit up.
Right.
You understand? Hey, Rob. Yes. Sorry to interrupt. I just want to be mindful of Mr. Flood's time. It's coming up on 9:30. I don't know if you got a prison clock in front of you. Just keep it in mind.
One question, Mr. Flood. Can I squeeze one more out of you?
Yep. Go.
Okay. Mr. Flood, finding your way home takes a beacon of light, right? A lighthouse in the form of someone who has previously lost themselves, someone who has experienced the same trials and tribulations. We were just talking about that. Who fully understands the obstacles on the road to success. Your personal story is invaluable. What advice would you give to those incarcerated in regards to the importance of education and resources as they prepare for their eventual release?
Yeah, you know, one of the things you talked about is, you know, certainly having being able to acquire a skill set will be helpful. But I think there's nothing, regardless of whatever field you think you need to pursue or line of work you decide to get into, becoming an effective communicator will take you everything, right? So for me, and folks need to do that now. But I was a very reserved person before I came to prison. You couldn't get me to speak publicly. No matter what state you're operating, you have to communicate more effectively. Do that, the probability be successful. You know, one of the things for me, when I was at FBI Justice, they had a university, had public speaking, had to be. Right. You know, so that opened me up and enabled me to be an effective communicator. So, you know, while we're setting these goals, whether they're short-term, intermediate, and long-term goals, one of the ways to be able to achieve those goals is being able to effectively communicate what those goals are, be able to connect with those people, with those individuals, check with you, or towards your goal. So, yeah, definitely become an effective communicator. That would be the piece. You're going to have to communicate with regardless of what state you're in. So, and if you're going to be doing advocacy work, it's going to be largely what will consist of is convincing and persuading others.
You have 1 minute left
to look at your side of it. So that would be one of my suggestions.
Mr. Flood, I want to sincerely thank you for taking this time to be on LWOP Radio. I also want to thank you for your transparency you exhibited for each and every one of my questions, man. It was an honor. Best of wishes to you and all your future endeavors. Don't be a stranger to the show. You're always welcome back, man. Peace and blessings to you, man. And take care of yourself, man.
And my pleasure, and likewise, man.
Yep. All right, bro. And Rob, take good care. And after you go, I ask the listeners to stick around because I'll be getting into with Mr. Flood more about what he does, what he's done,
absolutely,
and why he's doing it.
All right. So, Randy Rob signing out. Y'all be safe out there. Stay, hold us down. And Mr. Flood, thanks again for being on the show. Peace and blessings to all. I'll see y'all next week. I know. Tune in.
Okay.
Thank all you right. for using
Bye,
Securus.
Rob.
Goodbye.
Love and emotion endlessly.
Thanks for hanging in there with us.
Oh, absolutely.
So let's just backtrack a little bit, if you don't mind, and just give our listeners, please, a little basic introduction to yourself and outline some of the affiliations and the positions that you've had throughout your career.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've certainly jumped around a bit. My current role, I serve as Deputy Director of Government Affairs for CSPIR PA. For those that don't know about CSPIR PA, for Pennsylvania's leading gun violence prevention advocacy organization. So that's my current role. I also serve as the founder and owner of the Lazarus Firm, which assists people with the state pardon process, the federal clemency process, as well as some employment discrimination work with people with criminal histories. And then I would say over the course of the last decade or so, I spent most of my time with the House of Representatives, Pennsylvania House of Representatives, various capacities from ledge assistant to executive director. Spent some time with the Department of General Services as their policy and reporting specialist. And folks more know, I'm more renowned for my role as Secretary of the Pennsylvania Board of Pardons.
Yes, that's how we met. Okay, so can you tell us a little bit about your official duties as Deputy Director at CSPIR PA?
Yeah, sure. So my primary role is to drive the policy side of the house. So I'm advancing public policy, whether that's administrative policy for law enforcement agencies. My main work is lobbying the Capitol. So whether I'm pushing for a certain gun safety legislation to pass, or conversely, if I'm pushing to stop bad legislation or legislation that would expand access to firearms, but my job is to beat back those policies. And, you know, certainly my role is to be able to interface with local, state, and federal elected officials to do all that we can on the gun violence prevention side.
Mm-hmm. So speaking about gun violence, I'm a resident of the city of Philadelphia. And I have concerns, as most of us do, with regard to the violence, you know, inside of our city right now. So I'm just curious if you can shed some light on what CSPIR PA is doing in particular, as an organization that's different from other organizations, to go to the root of this issue.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I had mentioned and one thing I want to clarify is, you know, our main role, we look at ourselves as solution-oriented connectors, right? So you have a ton of folks that are nonprofits, city-based or city-level agencies that are there to assist people with just not the social side, but also preventing recidivism, right? So they're providing a lot of those services, those interrupters, making sure that people, that workforce development side. So we don't work in that space directly, but what our role is to connect folks with those resources, connect like-minded organizations that may have capacity issues to help them work together. And as you heard me mention earlier about lobbying the state for more funding, especially for community violence intervention. So making sure those nonprofits that are doing the work, those grassroots organizations, are able to tap into those state monies to not just be able to do the work for 6 months or a year, but to do it on a recurring basis, right? So, you know, even with this fiscal year's budget, our aim was to get $100 million for these organizations. Unfortunately, we were only get $40 million, but $40 million beats a zero any day. Mm. So that's what our role is really connectors and really the education and outreach piece, too. Mm-hmm. Right? You can't just get legislators to change the laws just from a conversation. So part of what we do is we educate and mobilize the constituents of those legislators to advance those policies.
So it sounds like people could get involved, if they wanted to, they could get involved in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. We have organizers, too. We have about, I believe the last time I checked, we've got 50,000 volunteers and affiliates. So, you know, folks can do anything from phone banking to helping us with our lobby days at the Capitol, coordinating, you know, community events or panels, discussions, or just having those roundtable discussions with legislators. So there, we have a role for you, you know, no matter your age, no matter your background. We certainly can utilize your help, and certainly we consider that to be important work. So we look forward to anyone who's interested in working with us. We're pretty easy to find.
And I appreciate what you said, too, that you are working to make sure that the organizations that have people who are really in the know and connected to the communities and to the problems most directly, that they're supported. I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Let's switch a little bit to the Lazarus firm that you founded. Would you like to say a few more words about the services? I mean, you mentioned them briefly, but you know, maybe more specifically, so people know if it's a good fit for them.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you raised that point too about a good fit, right? Because you know, during my time with the former Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, we did a lot to expand Second Chances. But it's important to note that it's not like Oprah Winfrey Show, right? That everyone won't be eligible or suitable, can't just go in your seat and get a pardon, right? So there are some criteria that folks need to meet, and that's part of what my job is too. So I don't just help that person navigate through that process, that clemency process, whether it's a pardon or commutation. I also let them know, hey, listen, right now you're not a suitable candidate, but I also provide them with a roadmap to let them know, here's how you can become a suitable candidate. So, you know, that's certainly important for, you know, while the emphasis is making sure that people that are coming out of our prisons are able to reenter and reintegrate successfully and seamlessly, we also have to prepare people on how to navigate the workforce and life in general with the criminal conviction. So that's one of the things that I do. You heard me talk about employment discrimination. So as I said, not everyone's eligible to get their record clear, and more importantly, it takes some time to get your record clear, just the whole procedural process. So what I do is I help people challenge employers that may dismiss or terminate them because of their record, or may take them out of contention for a position, right? So that's the work that the Lazarus firm does.
That's good to know. So I don't know if you know, if I mentioned it, but I trained with Philadelphia Lawyers for Social Equity. And then I started also working with, I think it's Southeast Legal Aid, as a volunteer to coach people through the pardon application. You know, so helping people to figure out what documents they need to get from the courts, helping them write their personal narrative, helping them make sure all their T's are crossed, I's are dotted to submit the application. But those people are sent to me mainly from those two places. Sometimes people just kind of hear and they come to me. But one thing that has come up is really, honestly, like I'm shocked, although I shouldn't be, but the discrimination that you mentioned, you know, doesn't really matter the type of crime. It's like it almost doesn't matter, just any record at all, and how disheartening, and how much that can really break somebody who's reentering. So it's good to know that you do that, that you might be, sounds like you can help them, maybe point them also to other resources that could be helpful.
Yeah, you know, that extends to employment, that extends to housing. Obviously, I'm not a miracle worker, so, you know, I'm operating strictly by what the law says. And to your point, there are a lot of employers that don't know that Pennsylvania has a controlling statute on that dictates how employers are supposed to consider records and how they're supposed to utilize them. So my job is to make sure that they stay in compliance with that, and as I said, be able to challenge them. Because like you said, you know, a lot of these places, they frankly unlawfully yeah. use what people may know as that free portal where you can look up people's criminal dockets.
Yep.
A lot of those places use that portal, and it says very clearly on that portal, a disclaimer that tells people not to use it for background check purposes, but it's free, it's accessible, so a lot of employers use it because, you know, it's good for their overhead, right? They're, you know, so my job is to really kind of hold them accountable and say, hey, listen, because all they do is if they type your name in and anything comes up, to your earlier point, they don't look at the specifics. They're just seeing that something pops up and will automatically take you out of contention. So
okay.
it's certainly important work. And as you mentioned, you know, Pulse and, you know, Philadelphia Legal Services, the people that really got me into doing this work, too, was the Public Interest Law Center of Philadelphia. They got me into this work back in 2013. So this is something that, regardless of whatever I do professionally, I'll continue to work in this space in some capacity or another.
Okay, well, it's good to know, but unfortunately for you, you might hear from me sometime. Because I don't know, I didn't know there was a way, I didn't know how to hold some of these employers accountable. So another conversation, but good to know that you do this. So let's move on. Let's move on and wrap up since you've been so generous with your time today. You've spoken with my co-host, Reentry Rob, and you know, you're aware of this project he created, The Groves Notebook. And this radio station, this radio show rather, Life Without Parole Radio, is actually an extension of The Groves Notebook, which is a Facebook page. So these are these two platforms he's using to educate the general public on what many people are doing while they're incarcerated and how they're using their time and their resources that they're given while serving a life without parole sentence, you know, productively. And this is his way of providing visual and audio confirmation that people who are serving a death by incarceration sentence are not incorrigible. So I'm sure you know how much Rob appreciates you lending your voice and your support to the platform, and by extension, the Groves Notebook platform as well.
Yeah, listen, you know, the media is a very powerful tool. It can work in your favor, and certainly can work against you. So, you know, I love that, you know, and as we see, when it comes to mainstream media, when it comes to folks that have been impacted by the legal system, we often get the negative perspective of folks that are in the penal system or that are otherwise justice involved. So being able, sometimes you need that platform, that vehicle to counteract the prevailing narratives that are out there. And, you know, so, you know, you often don't see too many good doers and what the folks are doing behind the walls in mainstream media. You know, and obviously me being someone who was behind those walls myself and someone who did a lot of constructive things, not just for the sake of the inmate population and the institution, but also for my own personal development. You know, that's happening every day. These are men and women who are working to become better people, become change agents, not just, you know, for their respective communities, but statewide and globally. So, for anyone who's providing these platforms and again, are providing these counter narratives, I want to support that 100%. So I look forward to continuing to support the brother and his efforts. And then, too, we talk about clemency and commutation. Some of this stuff is even instructive for these decision makers, parole board, too. Decision makers who literally have other people's lives in their hands and are able to get more context about, you know, what they're doing. And also for the victim community, too. You know, one of the things when I was secretary of the Board of Pardons during my initial press conference, I said that, the victim community, despite me being a formerly convicted felon, you know, making sure that victims' voices were at the forefront would be a policy or a principle that I would continue to hold up. And, you know, and you have a lot of folks in the victim community that support second chances. And a lot of times that narrative's not put out there. So I appreciate the brother for what he's doing. I appreciate you for helping to put the wind behind his sails. And as I said earlier, feel free to use me as a resource moving forward.
Excellent. That was a really beautiful, heartfelt answer. And I just wanted to add one thing to it is, too, from me, just a little bit that I've been able to do with Rob. We've done, I don't know, this is like our 22nd or 23rd episode, on a continuous weekly basis. But I get the privilege and the honor of speaking with all these different individuals who are serving these really harsh sentences, and I get to witness the hope, you know, just that, you know, that comes from just being able to express themselves for a paltry 15 minutes on the airwaves. You know, it's not an opportunity that they get that often. So that's just like my vantage point.
No, and that's important too. You mentioned that. You know, I should also mention, you know, it was largely the guys that were serving life or were otherwise long-term offenders that poured into me as an 18-year-old who first went upstate, or as a 22-year-old when I came back, right? So they gave me a lot of foundational tools that when I did decide to fly right, end up proving to be quite advantageous for me. So, you know, they were doing this work for free just because they saw something in me worth, you know, investing in. So, you know, when I left Chester in 2010, you know, I pledged to do all I can to make sure that the people who were behind the walls with me and who poured into me, that I would pay it forward. So
that's awesome, and that's real. It's called transformative justice.
Right.
Yeah, it goes beyond restorative justice. So thank you for helping to transform our systems in only the way that, you know, you can. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today. What's that?
I look forward to coming back too.
Well, we'd love to have you. Thank you, Brandon Flood. We wish you a happy Friday and a really good weekend.
Thank you, and likewise.
Okay, take care.
And I'm going to wrap up here in a couple minutes. But before I do, getting a little bit of feedback, so just bear with me. I just wanted to say that when I get off the radio today, I'm actually on my way to a local prison. Because I teach mindfulness. I volunteer mindfulness with the youth and the women there. And the youth that I see, that I've been seeing for several months, they're there because of first and second degree charges. So when Rob was talking with Brandon about the youth of today, and he said something about, you know, how do we reach the youth when they don't feel like they're lost? And he said, you know, it's like they feel like this is a badge of honor they wear going to prison. I'm definitely not myself living in that community, so I can't speak to that. I do work in communities. I do offer mindfulness to youth in really impoverished, you know, communities in particular. But the boys and the young woman I'm going to meet today that I've been working with, it's not so much, I feel like, them realizing they're not lost. It's more like when I work with them with mindfulness and meditation, it's kind of like I'm pointing them to return or to remember. It's really just a way of paying attention that's like open and non-judgmental. So if we can all kind of remember or be guided by someone else, we truly can't remember how to really focus our attention to our external stimuli as well as our internal stimuli in a way that is non-judgmental. We're just taking it in and allowing it to be. It doesn't mean we don't do something to change something that needs to be changed, but in the moment, you know, making space for the reality and then being open, because our minds are so made up, but just being a bit more porous and being curious. That's where the possibility lies. One short little teeny sample of what mindfulness could be, because it doesn't have to be meditation the way we picture it in the movies, you know, cross-legged going om with our eyes closed. That's just one way it might look in one culture. It's really, again, anything that we're doing that's just incorporating this way of paying attention. So a sample of that would be the way that we walk. So particularly when one's in prison, it can be hard to kind of get still and to find a peaceful place to meditate. So just walking could be really helpful. I'll just do a short little guided example. So just bringing your attention, if you're sitting or standing, to your feet. And noticing your feet against the ground and how the ground feels underneath your feet. And just feeling into the soles of your feet on the ground. Noticing your arches and how each toe is connected. Noticing your breath. And then if you're standing, I invite you to take one step. And as you lift your foot to take a step, notice how your weight shifts to your other leg and your other foot. And when you put the foot that's up down on the ground, feel the weight of your body shift onto that foot that's coming down. Notice your ankles and how they stabilize your posture. Notice what's happening to your arms, if they move slightly, if your body sways. Notice how you're already ahead, right? You're already ready to take another step with your other foot. And seeing if you can have that urge without the urge having you. And then go ahead and lift up your other foot. Notice all that's involved as you put that foot down. And then you would just repeat this process with each step. And maybe even connecting more deeply to your breath, maybe synchronizing your breath step, like taking a breath when you lift up, maybe exhaling as you put the foot down. But the idea is to focus on each step, and as your mind wanders, which it totally will, to notice it's wandered, and then just gently bringing your attention back to your feet on the ground. And each step. So that's just a little example of some of the things that we do together. And this brings us to the end of the show, Life Without Parole, LWAP Radio. I invite you to join us every Friday at 9 a.m. And again, this show is an extension of the Groves Notebook, which is a Facebook page. And if you'd like to submit a profile to the Groves Notebook to be featured on there, someone, if you're serving a life without parole sentence or you have a loved one or a friend who is, please just follow the directions on that Facebook page and contact the administrator. You can connect as well with me, Stacy, at Your Big Mind on Instagram. You can connect with Reentry Rob through the connectnetwork.com. He's at SCI Phoenix. His email is robertgroves731@gmail.com. And as always, we are grateful to Lester Kinnion at FetLifeStation.com. Enjoy your Friday. Have a safe, peaceful weekend. Sending everybody peace. I know exactly who you could be. So just hold on, we're going home. Just hold on, we're going home. Things alone. Just hold on, we're going on. Just hold on, we're going home. Just hold on, we're going home.